Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware, a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Jorge Riera. We'll talk to Jorge about natural wines, Franchette, and more. We'll taste a red from the Loire et Cher that Jorge graciously is serving me. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Jorge Riera has been drinking and promoting natural wines in New York almost longer than anyone. He started at Red Hook's 360, worked at Balthazar, spent many years at Ten Bells, Contra, and Wild Air, and now is the wine director at Franchette, one of New York's most talked about restaurants serving only natural wines. Jorge Riera is a bigger-than-life guy and a true believer and evangelist of natural wines, but wasn't always that way. Got here, and he's going to tell us about that. So, Jorge, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So what I want to do is I want to get... give everyone an idea of who you are. So give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are today, which is Franchette. But walk me through, you know, the current.
Well, I'm a native of New Yorker, born and raised in Brooklyn, which are kind of rare these days, living in New York City.
People live in Brooklyn, and
exactly.
Not born from Brooklyn, right?
Exactly. But I was... got to the restaurant business by default, like a lot of other people, and started. I opened up an American restaurant that was, I'd rather not say the name, but it's very famous back then in Soho. And I had a really bad distaste for the wine program that they had, not knowing anything about it. It's just me being
just
the person.
A gut feeling?
Just a gut feeling. And from there, I worked in a little French bistro in Midtown, in Gramercy area, that kind of changed my mind because I started tasting wines of France and the expressions in Beaujolais. I got a very early access to Jean Foyard, Marcel Lapierre, and these guys in Beaujolais and Alsace. And not knowing how they made the wines then, I gravitated towards those wines due to the accessibility and just the easiness in drinking the wines and how they went with foods. Later, after that, I opened up Balthazar in 97. Jonathan Nossiter, who everyone knows from his documentaries, and worked early on in El Buco, did the list there and did a list that was very anti-Soho at the time. He worked with all small producers.
And what's anti-Soho? I'm just trying to think.
Well, Soho back then was like these big restaurants that were opening up. They were super trendy. They had, you know, all the Bordeaux
the trophy stuff. Okay.
And he opened up this list that you had to work with the customers that were coming in there. They were like high fashion people, you know, the A-listers of New York City that didn't want to hear where this little farmer is. They wanted A, B, and C.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, he gave us a challenge to start with, and a lot of the wines within the list then were made natural, but that was a word that wasn't used back then in the late 90s. And we had Darden Rebo, we had Claude Cotoir, we had Lapierre, we had Foyard, we had, you know, Nicolas Joly that we had to sell to the people. And those wines really spoke to me. And, you know, when I started working at 360 in Red Hook with Arno Earhart.
How did you come to meet Arno?
Arno and I, we opened up Baltazar. So we met Baltazar.
Yeah, I didn't realize that.
And he left to open up his own restaurant. And I had, you know, this is 3 years down the road now. And I was working another place and I was helping him out. And the night that Eric came in, that he was doing his 25 and under, is when I decided to just stay there because I knew it was going to be busy. And it was just a different pace from working in Manhattan all those years. And I really loved what he put together. He put a really evangelist, all-natural wine program that back then the bottles were like $18. The three-course prefix was $20. You know, it was unheard of to do this today.
Die for a place like that in any neighborhood, right?
But it was great to introduce these wines to this whole crowd in Red Hook, in Brooklyn, in New York in general, and just to talk about the wines, you know. It was really engaging.
Was anyone doing that?
No one was doing that.
Really?
Yeah, and then it slowly, you know, people started catching on, and, you know, restaurants were being designed within the dining room, you know, that are successful today in Brooklyn. And it was just a fun and a very special place. And for me, it was the most authentic French bistro that there is, you know, slightly modeled kind of with the feeling of what Baratin is in Paris, but it was a very special and unique place. And I still have customers that come to Frenchette now.
That were there.
That were there, that follow, that only drink natural wine since
but
then.
But this has
exposed.
A similar vibe in the sense that it's neighborhoody and warm and all of that.
Yes.
All right, so you're there how long?
I was there 5.5 years, practically, yeah.
Yeah. Then what happened?
And then from there, I went to, actually, I came to this space. It was called Cercle Rouge. And it was owned by Georges Forgerois, who had a pretty simple list at the time. And I said, if I come here, I'm going to change the whole list natural. He agreed, and I did that. I ran that for 8 months, but I realized the food wasn't really what I wanted. And that's when they had wanted me to open up 10 Bells. And I had committed to George here. And after when I wasn't happy, I wound up going to 10 Bells for 5.5 years.
So 10 Bells is a good example of how the natural wine scene movement and bars is starting to evolve, right?
Yeah.
Opening a place like that?
Yeah. That place was a foot link in Manhattan as a natural wine. Because, you know, you have a lot of these mama and pop restaurants in Brooklyn that were starting to do this because of 360, but in Manhattan, that was the only place for a very long time. And that's where I met Jeremiah and Fabian, because they were looking for, they just got back from Europe. They were looking for their space. They were coming in every day, and we made friends, and, you know, they were coming in basically, I think they almost signed their lease in 10 Bells.
At the bar.
Yeah.
Tell everyone who Jeremiah and Fabian are.
Yeah, Jeremiah Stone and Fabian Van Huska, they have these two great restaurants on Orchard. One is called Contra. That opened first. That was an all degustation, you know, prefix menu. Similar to what we were doing, you know, similar to what we did in 360 and the European model of prefix. And then we opened up a wine bar next door called Wilder that it was a la carte.
Wilder or Wilder?
Wilder.
Okay,
was the real
say
name,
it right.
No one,
Will
no
you
one,
worry? Don't make me come over that side
from
of the
Brooklyn.
Table.
I say Wilder. But
how long after did Wilder open? After
2 years.
2 years.
Two
okay.
years, yeah. And that place was focusing on a la carte, and I kind of really expanded on the list and did a lot more large formats because there was a lot more by the glass there, and I went to different regions that I wasn't going in Contra. In Contra, I mainly stayed within France, a lot of Loire, and I put a wine pairing on the menu that didn't exist before, and it was super successful, and I did really unorthodox pairings, and you know, and I had a lot of fun with it.
So it gave you a chance to expand, grow, whatever.
Exactly.
So at this point, you're doing wine programs at restaurants that are kind of coined natural wine bars. I mean, what's expanding? Are you traveling? Are you meeting winemakers? Is there more product available? Things are changing, right?
Yeah, things are changing. I mean, there's constantly a new winemaker to discover. There's more wine that you can possibly, you know, put on the list. And, you know, when you go into these fairs in Europe or, you know, Vienna, you meet other growers, younger growers or sons of famous houses that are going in this route that, you know, non-traditional. that are looked down at in places like Germany, in Austria, that are going against the family grain, you know, to work in this expressive manner.
Right.
You know,
right. And so it's about the people.
It's about the
people. As you meet the people, it turns you on to trying the wines.
Absolutely.
And then supporting them, right?
Yep, absolutely.
So you're able to do that at Contra, even expand more at Wild Air. You do that for what, about 4 or 5 years?
I did that for 4.5 years.
Right. Great notices on the food, on the wine, on both places. So how does the... Is there any lapse between that and Frenchette?
No.
Tell me how the Frenchette thing comes about.
Actually, Riyadh and Lee, they picked up the phone one day and they gave me a call and they said, we're going to do this project. You know, we worked together at Baltazar and...
just quickly tell everyone who Riyadh and Lee are.
If you don't know who Riyadh and... Riyadh, Nazar, and Lee Hansen, they're pretty much, furniture in the New York City dining scene. They opened up Danielle back in the day. Lee worked at Oreo, which was a very famous restaurant. Charlie Palmer. And Lee and Riyadh was working at Park Bistro in Leal. That's where we met. Okay. Pre-Bourdain.
Right. Okay.
It's funny because the millennials now these days, they only know that restaurant through Bourdain. Was in a decade before him.
Yeah.
But that restaurant was instrumental in New York City in the fact that it was one of the first to put onglet on the menu. It was the first to put skate wing on the menu.
Right.
I mean, they did a lot of things back then that no one was doing with French cuisine. But
Lee and Riyadh were very prominent and influential with... what's his name?
Keith McNally.
McNally.
Yeah.
All the Balthazar, which he worked at.
That's when it kind of changed because Keith decided to hire two real chefs. He never really had a chef in any of his restaurants.
Right.
There were cooks, and they hired two chefs that have a vision, that knew about food, that really, you know, Keith being the Francophile that he is, they were immersed and based in that French system, and they opened up, you know, what it is now, an institution. You know, we did something in Soho that no one was doing back then. We created a brasserie, and it was successful since day one.
Still has the chops today.
You
know, it's still as good as anything. All right, so you meet up with those guys. They're telling you about the project. You come to Frenchette. Frenchette opens. It's fairly recent.
This is our 7th month in existence, so it seems like it's 3 years old already.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
It was a delay because the fact when I was leaving Contra, we were supposed to kind of open up at that time, and it was just, you know, it's New York City, construction, Con Ed.
Well, that
it just gets delayed. Next thing you know,
torture.
We open up April 2nd. So
you open in April.
We open in April.
Incredible notices.
Yeah.
Incredible notoriety. I'll make you a side bet. It's one of the most Instagrammed restaurants, probably.
Really?
I bet you.
Yeah. And, you know, when they approached me with this project, you know, I liked the platform that it was giving me to show and really, you know, show the people not to be afraid with the wines, how you should eat. This one, you know, drink these wines, eat the food, and just the mariage that it does, you know. And it's funny because some people thought I was going to get a really, you know, I was going to struggle, but, you know, a lot of the people in the neighborhood, they were drinking these wines already, you know, and it's just like, it was really nice for them. They were so happy. They travel. You know, the world is so small. You know, you have this circle that go to Paris, to go to Copenhagen, they eat in New York, and they all have these wines. They all see these wines. So
right.
It's like a circle.
So it's great for you to expose to them.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to talk to you about the wine program here.
Yeah.
In a few minutes, but I want to ask you a bunch of questions before we get to that. You know, I don't have the opportunity to sit across from a guy like you that really, you know, has dedicated his career to wines and natural wines. So it's not the first time I've asked this question, but I want your take and your definition on what a natural wine is. You just got into it a little. We talked about it before.
Yeah.
You know, it's tagged differently. It's perceived differently. How do you see it?
It's I call it like live wine, real wine. It's okay. So it's wines that are farmed most importantly in the vineyards without the use of any chemicals, and no pesticides, no herbicides. So there's a life in the vineyards that exists. Okay. There's and they strip away all the additives you can add in wines. This is something that a lot of people don't know, that there's a lot of additives with, like, mass-produced foods. There's a lot of additives with wines. There's, you know, you could put flavoring, you could put ink coloring, you know, you could put wood flavor, you could put any type of fruit you want that the customer to perceive, you can add it into the wine.
So it tastes the same every bottle, every year, every vintage.
Every year, and they add so much sulfites, and sulfites, you know, in large quantity is a poison. Therefore, when you wake up the next morning after drinking two or three bottles of champagne that have been dosed with sugar, that beyond belief, and has sulfites, you wake up with a massive headache. Just like you will wake up if you drink a bottle of vodka, because vodka and these spirits all have a lot of sulfites to give it shelf life. That's why they can stay in the sun.
Right.
And you can sell the bottle and walk away.
Not necessarily a good thing in the long run, you know?
So, you know, these are live products, and it's like, you know, having an apple, you pick it from the tree, you put it on the, and it's supposed to rot after a day or two, you know what I mean? But
it's an agricultural product.
It's for me, drinking these wines, they speak to me in a different way, and that's why I was so affected in 2000, 2002, 2003, when I went to the vineyards and saw what they were doing firsthand. It really spoke to me. They made wine for the people in a very humble way, and they farmed in a very traditional way. And when you drink these wines, your body just accepts them. It's just drinking juice. My mother, who doesn't drink any wine, she's 84 years old, God bless her. When I have dinner with her sometimes, she goes, I want a glass of wine. And I look at her, I said, what? And she goes, I want the wines that you drink because they taste like juice. And she does not know anything or drink at all, you know?
Well, is it fair to say that in the majority of natural wines, the alcohol tends to be a little lower, which makes it drinkable, which your mom is sort of an unofficial, testament to that.
Absolutely. Wine 100 years ago was a more nutritious drink, you know. It's made from grapes. It's supposed to be healthy for you, you know, low alcohols, low tannins, you know, low extraction. It's just supposed to, it's
that all changed through the years. So you talked about the farming, which is organic, biodynamic, you know, the farmers, vigneron's, care about sustaining the land too. Then you get in the cellar.
Yes.
So the wine is made there. You can't screw it up in the cellar. So how do you stay natural?
So this is the most important thing, because you can grow grapes organically and do all that work in the vineyards. And then when you get to the cellar, you know, yeasts exist. And you can inoculate yeast. You can use, you know, yeast number 238 or 247. Or you can have yeast that's ambient in your cellar that starts the fermentation. And these are what many and all of these farmers do. And they don't add anything. And they don't strip away. They don't really filter. They do a filtration that's very rough, okay? So you get a lot of the, you know, you get whites that are more turbid looking, you know, because they're filtered. They're not stripped away. They don't look like a glass of water, more or less.
That's a big thing with natural wines.
Yeah.
I mean, unfiltered, a lot are unfined. So the appearance
to
some people, it's like, what's going
on
here?
Yeah, what's going on? It's like, you know, why does this apple look like an apple that I see on an emoticon? And why does this apple look all gnarly?
No pesticides.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know.
What about the acidity?
The acidity is normally on the higher side. It's because of the richness in the soils. The acidity has a great balance with the amount of fruit that's in the wine. Sometimes, you know, these guys don't manipulate. They don't heat the wine up.
I was just going to ask. They don't play with the acidity.
It comes out the way they vent it. Always an ambient temperature. You know, whatever the cellar's at, it's at 20 degrees or 30 degrees. The wine is working, and they let it work. And they're tasting it. And when they deem that it's ready, some might put very little sulfites in the bottling, okay? Which by the time it gets here, it gets eaten up in the wine, and you open it, and it's gone.
And there's sulfites naturally in wine too,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So that
you'll always see, even with wines that don't have any added sulfur, even in this country, it's by law, by
because
the TTB.
Because it's naturally in there.
Yeah, it's naturally in there, and that's a fact. You know, all grapes contain sulfites. And
so I don't know if this question makes sense or not, but in your mind, in natural wines, and you're going to say both, but what has the biggest impact, or what's more important? Is it the farming or the
farming.
Winemaking? You answered without hesitation.
The farming.
And
is
by the
so
way,
important.
I've asked that question a bunch of times. It's farming 10 out of 10 times.
You can tell how good the wine is when you don't see the when the grower is always in the farm and always in the vineyards, it's extremely important. And when you go to the vineyards and you see firsthand what's happening, it's
that's a vigneron, right?
That's a vigneron.
A guy who farms and makes his own wine.
The cellar is the easy part. When they bring the grapes to the cellar, that's the easy part. The work, the hard work, is in those vines, in the vineyard.
Because there's no manipulation, no additions in the cellar making and all that.
Absolutely.
You've done your job, now let it rest, you know,
and
move
that's
naturally. How do you eliminate the preconception people may have about how a wine should taste, specifically natural wines? Now have a preconceived notion.
Yeah, they have a preconceived notion. I think they need to forget the wines... The word natural.
Okay.
I think that scares a lot of people, and they think that it's gonna smell of a horse's ass, and you know, and
cloudy,
cloudy and barnyard. It's good wine. It's farmed in a certain way, but it's all good, real wine. And I think that notion they just have to get rid of. You know, I don't have on any of the lists that I work with, even in 360, 10 Bells, Contro Wilde. It doesn't say. Natural wine list.
Right.
It's wines. Okay, you want to find out about the wines? I'll tell you how the wines are made. But they're good wines. They're well-made wines that the farmer decided not to use herbicides, pesticides, and farmed with horses and everything by hand. But they're good wines. And don't be afraid of these wines. These wines are really, you know, you're either going to like them or you're not going to like them. It's just like eating.
But like anything.
Like anything.
Asparagus.
Yeah.
You're going to love them or you're going to. So if somebody walked in here and they had no idea about you or the program, you know, and 2-3 couples, they drink 4 or 5 bottles of wine. They have no idea what natural wine is and your program. They're drinking some of the greatest wines in the world. That's why they don't have to be, you know, labeled.
And it's funny how I've been seeing people here drinking 4 or 5 bottles because of the easiness in drinking these wines and how, you know, how they go with food, how they match with everything. And they just, you know, the bottle disappears. The wine, the easiness...
So, we're being repetitive, but tick the list off for me. They're easy drinking because they're generally lower alcohol, so you're not getting loaded up on that.
Yeah.
The acidity is complementary to food.
Yeah.
What else? The tannins are not...
The tannins are not gripping and, you know, ripping the enamel off your teeth. There's not too much sugar in them. You know, it's all natural sugars. So, you know, you're not getting this overbearing of stuff that you don't need in your body. It's
easier to drink.
Yeah.
It's got
high drinkability.
Why do you think, you know, God bless guys like you who, you know, talk about all these wines, serve them, and have spent a lot of time. Why do you think most mainstream and legacy restaurants don't really, you know, participate in wines like this on their list?
Well,
you know, they may have a token or two.
Yeah. I think that's the easiness it is to... I mean, you have to work with these wines. This is work. These wines are not mass-produced. You know, these
guys... What does that mean? Getting them? Knowing them? What's right?
No, they're not making 200,000, 300,000 bottles. They make 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 bottles. So, you know, it takes work in finding them and getting them and working with these small companies. A lot of people, they dial it in. They have people that are making... Their wine list from big companies, and they put all this wine. They don't
Why
bother?
So that's one reason.
Yeah.
What about the stigma people may have of natural wines? I mean, what's another reason they'll stay away from it?
That's the stigma of natural wine because it's a self-defense mechanism. Because they don't know about it, they're like, this is no good, you know? And, you know, in Bordeaux, there's natural winemaking going on. You know, there's... Many things that are happening.
Burgundy, it's existed for years.
Yeah, for years, you know. You just have to know and put in the work, you know. And a lot of people, they decide, you know, why do you want to use, you know, a pig farms that are, you know, and chickens that are raised in an inhumane way, or you want to spend an extra to get live, you know, in this country, poultry was way more money, a really good rare breed bird was more money than beef, and now it's the opposite. It's all factory farming,
you know,
and
it's unethical, you know, it's not healthy and all that,
you know,
and that always translates to agricultural products.
Absolutely. I mean, this is an agricultural product. It's a food that's grown just like anything else, and it's, you know,
if you and I name the 5, you know, best big legacy type restaurants, I would also guess and confirm this for me that a big chunk of the clientele doesn't care. I mean, they want those trophy Bordeaux, Burgundies.
They don't want
to
think about it.
So they're not pushing for it either.
No, yeah.
That may never change. What do you think?
It may never change. I mean, within this, you know, it should remain like this, because if it changes, we wouldn't be able to get these wines. It'll be impossible.
Right. Because you're dead. You were the first guy standing.
I wouldn't be able to get these wines.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost not fair. It's like the New York Yankees. They could buy whoever they want.
It needs to remain. And there's such a popularity now within the world. I mean, there's a natural wine bar in Singapore, Hong Kong. You know, Japan is huge consumers of natural wine. So it's like, you know, these wines are spreading in areas, you know, in Russia, that they were never before, and they're gonna get harder to get.
Right.
You know,
but
there's always new people making wine. There's always new people to discover.
It's not gonna get easier though, even with all that.
No.
But you have your relationships and you've committed yourself.
Yes.
All right, I want to ask you about a bunch of wines. This is more of like a buzz round thing. Give me some quick responses and all that,
because
I think these are all things that are, you know, on the landscape of natural wines. Just give me reactions, explanations. Pet Nats, definitely a natural wine thing. Not everyone knows about them.
Pet Nats predate Champagne. I mean,
right.
Petit Natural.
Method Ancestral. Right.
I mean, I love those wines. I have a large section of a list. Actually, it's the first page of the wine list here. It's before Champagne, and it's great, fun bubbles, you know, at really accessible pricing.
Why would I order... I mean, I know both well, but I want your answer. Why would I order a Pet Nat over a Champagne?
I know
each one has their wheelhouse, but...
I mean, I love Champagne too, but I think Pet Nats are just fun. I think, you know, they're a lot of fun to, you know, to have on a table. You know, you don't have to stretch yourself thin on drinking a bottle of Champagne. You could drink two or three or four Pet Nats and just have like skin macerated ones, have rosés, have whites, and they're a lot of fun.
Made from all grapes.
Yeah, made from all grapes.
So it's a fun, great, you know, it's a good food wine and all that. How about orange wine? You hear a lot about it.
Yeah.
Tell people quickly what orange wine is and what's your feeling.
Orange wines, I don't like to use the word orange that much.
Skin macerated?
Macerated whites. I call them all white wines. I have them on the list. I don't have a special section for them because that's how white wines always look like this a thousand years ago. But I like a lot of the macerated wines. But there's a balance also, you know, you don't want to lose the taste of the grape too much. You want to still recognize what
some people make wines where just the grape.
Yeah, you can recognize. It's kind of gone. So there's a bit of a learning curve on that when people start working with macerations, how long and what is the best expression on grapes. And the winemakers will tell you, you know, I had Dario Princek, who makes beautiful Pinot Grigio that looks like a red wine, okay?
Really?
And he's discovered that for him, he used to highly extract the Pinot Grigio, and now he extracts it for about 10 days, and he feels that that's the optimum extraction for his grape, you know?
He figured it out.
Yeah, there's other people that extract it longer and less, you know? So they experiment.
And so that's one of the knocks could be over-extraction.
Yeah, over-extraction, high tannins, and it just
doesn't
go down. Yeah,
drinkable.
I mean, but in answer to your questions, it's a wine that's made like a red wine. So the juice sits with the skins, and that's how it gets the fleshiness of the red wine.
What about Georgian wines? What's your feeling? Made in amphora or claret?
Yeah, Georgian wines are great. The problem for many people is we don't have a reference for those 580 grapes that they have that we can barely pronounce.
So many varieties.
Yeah, so you can't say.
Chinori, all these crazy grapes.
Karkevi, all these wines, Cazzatelli, they're beautiful wines, and I tasted a lot of great natural wines from Georgia. But it really makes your brain expand because there's no reference. You can't say this is like a Chenin Blanc. This is like, no, it's its own thing. And you have to approach it as its own thing.
And going through it sort of for the first time.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But
you know,
what do you like what you see and taste?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're interesting?
Yeah, they're great. You know, things, Oak Rose Wines, Nicky Anzani, you know, John Vonderman, they're making really great wines right now.
So
you know,
people should
drink them. And there's a nice exchange that's happening between, you know, the winemakers in France and the Loire going to Georgia, seeing how they were doing things for like thousands of years without any manipulation.
That's right.
And them coming to Europe and learning from these natural winemakers of things that they that could help them. You know what I mean?
Very
it's
cool.
It's really nice.
We're talking to Jorge Riera. Jorge is the wine director at Frenchette. If you hear a little background noise, we're sitting at the bar in Frenchette, so it's all good and real ambiance. All right, one last thing on the list. Then we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about the wine program here. What's the story with domestic natural wines?
There's some good strides being made.
Getting better?
Getting better. You know, the problem that I find in a lot of the domestic wines is they don't do their own farming. They're buying the grapes. You know, they're overseeing the farming. But I think there's
a
slight disconnect with the grower and the winemaker.
Right.
That's
what's getting better. These guys are taking on their own property.
Exactly.
Or managing
a
property, you know, to every detail and all that. Is that the only way they'll get better and change if the winemakers become vigneron?
Yeah, I think that. And that, you know, they're pulling back on the high alcohol levels, and you know, they're making it more drinkable. They're doing some nice strides.
All right. I'm going to ask this last question, then we're going to break.
Yeah.
What regions, wines, winemakers, varietals, and we could probably do a whole show on this, but just give me top of mind that are exciting you right now.
Well, the Loire always excites me.
Okay.
I love the Loire. My heart is in the Loire.
There's stuff always happening, right?
Yeah, and the grapes there, that, you know, there's Aubois, there's Minopino, there's Romo Rantan, there's Grollo, there's Pinot Donis, there's all those ancestral varietals that exist that they're being worked with in a really beautiful way. And in Catalonia, there's, you know,
Catalonia, Spain.
Yeah, Catalonia,
so
the
you'll
Macabeo.
Die a Loire guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Catalonia, what's going on there?
Catalonia, there's a beautiful movement happening with the natural wines. You know, they're working with ancestral varietals as well, like Sumoy and Macabeo,
right,
and, you know, Trapat. And they're doing beautiful work. They're working a lot with Tinajas. You know, they don't call them Cuervi. They're called Tinajas, with amphora that they used, you know, was a traditional thing that they always made wines, you know, less woody, less, you know, this vanilla. And they're making really exciting stuff
there. Give me one more favorite exciting thing.
Also, Czech Republic and Slovenia. You know, this is an area that, you know, they've been making wines for.
What? Tell me two things. The predominant grapes they're making wines from, and there's a handful of influential winemakers from those areas.
Yeah, there's Nesterich that makes beautiful expressions of Pinot Gris and Müller Thurgau, you know, also really nice Pinot Noir, Blaufränkisch, you know. You have people like Christian Chida that's also working with
P-S-C-H-I-D-A.
Yeah.
Chida, I'll post everything on our social.
They're beautiful labels. You know, he's really
very
into
cool.
the art, you know. But he does beautiful expressions of Cab Franc and Blaufränkisch, Weissburgunder, Pinot Blanc, you know.
So some exciting stuff coming out of there.
Yeah.
Interesting grapes, too. Not what you'd expect, you know, from those countries. All right, those are some good ones. Like I said, I'm going to post as much information as you spew out on our websites. Jorge, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about the wine program at Frenchette. I have a thing called the wine list where I subject my guests to answer a few questions. Then we're going to taste some wine, and then we'll wrap it up. We're talking to Jorge Riera from Frenchette. This is The Grape Nation. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. When I'm not making food radio, I'm making food. And my favorite cookware is the 9-inch cast iron Le Creuset fry skillet that never leaves my stovetop. My Le Creuset recipe? Slab of bacon and some vegetables in the skillet. There is no better skillet than Le Creuset for my kind of skillet cooking. It spoils me. The heat retention is amazing. Heat a tortilla on super low heat. I even take my Le Creuset skillet with me when I travel. Bacon, quesadillas, burgers, chicken cutlets. Chefs always talk about sourcing the best quality ingredients, knowing your suppliers, using the right cookware and tools is just as important. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN. That's LECREUSET.com to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
All right, welcome back. We are talking to Jorge Riera. Jorge is the wine director at Frenchette in New York City. Jorge, I want to talk to you about the wine program at Frenchette now, because I know you came here for a reason and you've put a lot of thought into the program. So let's talk about how you select the wines here, why you selected you did, how does the program evolve? Is it seasonal? Mm-hmm. You know, what's the passion play behind it? Yeah. I mean, tell me as much about the program.
Well, it's predominantly all, I have over like 300 selections, Pet Nats, Champagne, and then it's predominantly French, okay? French is my love, and it's within France.
Isn't that true of every guy from Brooklyn?
Yeah, it's true. And within France, the Loire is the highlight for me. So I focus on a lot of family growers, you know, father and sons, Beaujolais, the Ardèche, Roussillon, I have a huge section of that I love. And I just expand from there, and I have Catalunya, Spain, a lot of Spanish wines, and Rioja Baja, Galicia. And I delve into a bit of Georgia, you know, Austria, Czech Republic, Italy. So it's a little bit of everything, but the main focus is France.
Okay. Yeah. So you said you had about 300 selections. Obviously, that rotates seasonally or even availability sometimes or whatever.
Yeah, a lot to do with availability because, like I said, you know, in the Loire the last 2 years, they've been decimated with frost and hail. So very little wine came this year. Luckily, in 18, it's going to be great because everyone's reporting huge yields. Everything's been great in the cellar. Everything is behaving the way it's supposed to. So it's really a great sign. So that they really needed that, you know. In Burgundy, they've been decimated in Beaujolais. So, you know, the wines that came this year, but there's always, like I said, there's always wine coming.
What about, as we talk for this interview, we're pretty much going into the cold weather.
Mm-hmm. Drink whites.
The opposite of what everybody thinks. You know, you kind of more from what people look at as warm weather and potentially, you know, wines there.
Drink whites and rosé.
Whites and rosé. All winter long. Rosé's year-round, right?
Yeah, I have like about 25 rosés.
So the point of that statement is don't believe the hype. Yeah. Drink good wines.
That's it. You're indoors.
So drink Loire whites, drink rosé, from everywhere and all of that. So let's talk about the food, because I'm assuming that when you and Lee and Riyadh sat down, they had a vision of what they wanted to put on the menu. You can't tell me that a lot of the thought of what you serve isn't compatible, you know, companion to the food.
No,
I always knew
that the list that I know them very well, and I know their style of cooking.
Right,
and I knew
that, what they that were part gonna, wasn't hard.
Yeah, so I already had. In my mind, I started to unfold like levels of like that I wanted to do for the list. I got very excited just hearing on some of the dishes that they were thinking about, and I knew exactly what I wanted to put together. You know, it was very easy for me actually, because going to France and, you know, and always having the type of foods that they wanted to execute and drinking these wines all this time, it was like a pleasure for me to finally put those two things together. You know,
so that wasn't hard at all.
It wasn't hard. It was super easy.
It was something that was probably subconsciously floating in your mind. Yeah, because you've been doing this and you knew these guys. You know? So it was fun to put the list together.
It was a lot of fun. A lot of fun.
We talked about this a little before, but most natural wines, all the wines we talked about, you know, the Loire and all that stuff, food friendly?
Extremely food friendly.
In general. We just talked about, you know, how you made it. Why food friendly? I know we're going to repeat this again, but...
Why food friendly? Because, A, it has the acidity that cuts through the richness of the food. It has the low alcohols.
And there's some rich food here.
Yeah, the low tannins, you know, and the drinkability that goes, you know. I mean, red with fish, light reds with fish, you know, rosés with meat, you know, whites with meat. It all goes into play. You know, like in Georgia, my friend John Okro, he says, you know, when we eat at the table, we eat food and we drink wine. There's no white goes with this and red goes with that. You know, it's like, it's all about the drinkability and the mariage between food and wine.
What about the clientele? I would guess they're diverse in the sense that they come in, have no clue.
A lot of them come in and
think they know everything.
No.
They come here because...
No, we have a real New York crowd in here, which is great. It's really hard to find a real New York neighborhood crowd as well. And they all know what they want, and a lot of them already were exposed to these wines, you know, being in the bistros in Paris, in the wine bars, going to Copenhagen, going to Japan.
That's why they're here.
And experiencing, that's why they're here, you know.
All right, so last question before we go to the wine list. What have you learned about natural wines in the time that you've been, you know, at this game? I mean, what do you know more today than then? What do you feel? I mean, what's changed?
I mean,
there's definitely been an evolution of you, the restaurant scene, the wines.
I just think the acceptability that's happened, that I've watched happen within New York, within the country, like, you know, you can now get these wines in Detroit. You can get these wines in Chicago. You can get these wines in Houston. You know, all along the West Coast is actually opened up now. And I think it's just the excitement behind it. I'm really happy to see.
Right.
You know, amongst the young and the older generation, it's just the embrace that's happening with these wines. And, you know,
Well, when you say young and older, younger is embracing it more than older, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, but, you know, here you see it more because you see the younger generation accepting the natural wines because this is, you know, sometimes they can say this is the cool thing to do, but, you know, they're really educating themselves.
Eventually.
It's about the wine.
Right.
And what I've noticed more is that the kids, the younger generation, they're not getting drunk on beer now. They're getting drunk on wine.
I know.
Which is really nice.
There's
it's like this European, it's been a big shift of young kids just like, I've seen 19, 20-year-old buying bottles of wine of like, natural wine, and I was like, wow,
that's
exciting to me.
That's
crazy. It's like being in France that you see these kids.
Do you think, what effect do you think social media has had and millennials?
Yeah, I'm not crazy about social media with wine because what it's done to certain...
Why?
Because I just don't like the way, you know, it's a showcase, and wine is a very personal thing. If I open up a bottle between you and I, it's you and me discussing this. I don't need, you know, to show this bottle. And a lot of people use social media saying, I have to drink this bottle. Like, I have to see, without really knowing what's behind the soul of the wine. You know, or the person.
You hit it on the nose.
You know, and
That's what a bottle of wine and sharing
it's
about.
It loses its soul. It's you know, it's about sharing, conversing, and talking about,
people
know,
forget
the
about
experience.
That, and all they want is the shot.
Exactly.
And all of that.
You know, it's funny. I've seen shots
that
I could have taken 15, 20 years ago, and I never did. You know why? I took the shot, but it was for my personal collection. And it's for me to remember that time and place that I shared this bottle with A, B, C, and D.
I agree with you. I take a lot of pictures with the intention of like, oh, look, I was here and drank. I wind up never.
Yeah.
I do stuff for the show, but personally, it really is about. I think one of the most, not one of the most important things, but an important thing that you said is what wine is about and the interaction and the experience. And natural wine even does more of that.
Yeah.
That's well said. All right, Jorge, we're going to do our wine list. Five questions. We ask the same five questions to our guests. You don't have to dwell on them.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to call this, it's called the wine list, but we're going to call this the Jorge Ribera Natural Edition. All right? All right, so here's the question, and you may have answered it, but get more specific. What are you drinking now?
What am I drinking now?
Are you trying new stuff for the restaurant? Are you expanding?
No, I'm not trying. I'm drinking a lot of El Basots.
You got to spell that for me.
El Basots is B-A-S-S-O-T-S. It's a Chenin Blanc made from a wine grower in Catalonia called Jean Ramon Escoda.
So it's a Spanish Chenin.
It's a Spanish Chenin macerated for about 10 days in Tinaja.
Okay.
In amphora.
Is the amphora.
Yeah, so it has this like nice fleshiness, low alcohol, and just you can drink bottle after bottle after bottle. So I've been drinking a lot of
that. Do you have it on the list?
Yes.
Okay.
I have it on the list as well.
So I think one of the few places. Anything else?
That and different rosés that I've been drinking. You know, I've been drinking Rosé from El Jalapines that's made from a grape from Catalina called Sumoy, which I like a lot.
S-U-M-O-L-L. Right.
Sumol or Sumoy, they say.
And who was the maker?
El Jalapín, Gloria Garriga. She's in Penedès. And as well as the new arrived Christian Cheetah Rosé, Himmel auf Erden, which is a Cabernet Franc, but really beautiful expression, really light, good minerality.
Good ones.
But fresh.
All right. Silly question, but people like to hear the answer. Does Jorge Riera have a favorite wine and food pairing? Is there something
Pinot
that...
Pinot Denis and oysters.
Explain what Pinot Denis is.
Pinot Denis is a pre-phylloxera grape from the Loire that's has a distinctive white peppery notes to it, wild rose flower, and it's a light red. Used to be more of a blending grape, but people have been making great, beautiful expressions of the red, and it goes really great with oysters. It's like a salt and pepper combination. It's really great.
So just so you know, that's a first on the show. We've done this about 100 times. You know, you always get champagne and oysters, fried chicken and champagne, steak and Cali calves. Yeah. But Pinot Denis and oysters, first time. Although oysters is a good food to pair. Yeah. So, all right. Without leaving anyone out or favoring anyone or incriminating, tell me your favorite natural wine restaurant and or bar. Let's stay in New York. If you're walking out of here and you want to hit something, anyone doing it well?
Yeah, I mean, I like what the Four Horsemen is doing. I like Wild Air. Wild Air is great.
Wild Air, right.
And Contra for a sit-down meal. They're really, really great places.
All good ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have, this is favorite all-time wine. Now, it doesn't mean the rarest or the most expensive. You know, usually when you talk to somms that work at big restaurants, you know, I had the 61 Petrus, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes it's experiential. You know, it's of the moment. What's a favorite all-time wine and why?
Favorite all-time? I mean, I would have to say...
Or a couple.
Yeah, there's been a couple. Tasting a 95 Pinot Gris from Terry Puzla in the over dinner blew my mind.
Okay.
Okay. And also tasting in the cellar with Pierre Breton, who's in Bourget. He makes Cabernet Franc. And we tasted a 1947 red that we all thought it was, you know, he made us guess. And we all thought, I guessed 89, 88, and it had so much life and so much fruit. And it was the only year, it's that exceptional year in France, 47, that they didn't sell the wine. So
all good
that was
ones.
Pretty magical.
I'm going to post all those. Those are all good ones. Last question. Best wine around $15-$20 retail. And here's my setup. I give it every time. I have kids in the 20s.
Yeah.
They are starting to make some money.
Yeah.
They can't act stupid anymore. When they go to a party, they got to bring a nice bottle of wine. But they're not spending 40 and they're not spending nine. So $15-$20, what am I buying red? What am I buying white? You can give me region. I mean, you can say Muscadet.
I think La Villana White.
That's the maker?
No, her name is Joy Cull. She's actually...
Spell her name for me.
Joy
J-O-Y. Like,
yeah, J-O-Y. Cull, K-U-L-L.
K-U-L-L.
She's Swiss, but was raised in Connecticut and moved to Italy in Lazio.
Jeez.
Yeah. And she's making wine on this volcanic area by Lake Bolsena. And it's just outside of Rome. And she's making these beautiful wines.
At that price point?
At that price point, yeah. And you can get, like, there's a white that she makes that's a Procanico. It's a grape from that area that she macerates for, like, about 4 days. And it's in concrete egg. It's called Ovo, in Italian.
Right.
And it's got this beautiful drawing by this great artist that's a descendant of Maurice Sendak called Jameson Odone. That's beautiful. It's really captivating label as well. And red, Christian Vignier, I think you might break 21 in a store.
V-E-N-I-E-R.
Yeah.
That's what we're going to drink now. We'll talk about it in a few seconds. So that's a great red.
Yeah.
Just with food.
Yeah,
and
it's really accessible and it's not really high priced.
All right, I'm going to post those. Those are two good ones. I may have to email you
for
some spelling or explanations. I don't want to send people to the wrong place. All right. So every week on the show, we do a thing called the Weekly Wine Sip. We taste a different wine on air. Yeah. You know, sometimes I bring the wine in. I come down here. I figure you could throw a glass out. So for our Weekly Wine Sip, Jorge picked the Venier.
Yeah.
So just name the whole label for me.
It's Le Haut de Madon, and okay. It's by Christian Vignier. Christian Vignier makes wine in the Loire in Cheverny, in Loire-et-Cher.
Right.
And this is a blend of mostly Pinot Noir with a bit of Gamay.
Nice.
And he's you know, farming land that's never seen a drop of a chemical since his grandfather was farming. He lives in an ancient village called Madon, M-A-D-O-N.
Right.
And
which is on the label, Le Haut de Madon.
Yeah, and he just makes a beautiful expression of this grape, and it's just lush, fresh fruit, easy drinking.
All right, so let's do a quick evaluation. Let's start with color.
Yeah.
So it's... It's little, a little cloudy.
Yeah.
It's a medium garnet?
Garnet, you know, deep ruby.
Yeah. Uh-huh. All right, so go nose for me. You're the expert. Give me the descriptor.
There's nice salinity. There's beautiful flowers.
Did you say salinity?
Yeah.
On the nose?
On the nose.
Okay, what else? Yeah. Flowers, what flowers, kind? White, red, violet?
Reds, okay. And red fruits, too, like bright red fruits. You know, cherries, strawberries, okay. Raspberries.
Let's go mouthfeel.
Yeah. Mouthfeel, it has that really nice acidity, really easy, the fleshiness of the red fruits in your mouth.
Wow.
That salinity along the sides. Just...
There's floral in
yeah.
the...
Yeah, yeah.
All right, so now give me the mouthfeel descriptors. I think a lot of the nose descriptors translate, it's an in-your-face mouthfeel. Yeah. So give me the description.
I think it's just a fleshy red fruit palate with that salinity behind it and that nice balance of acidity just washes over you.
Yeah.
You know?
The floral aspect's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, so give me some food pairings for this.
This you can have with pâté. You can have it with any meats. You can have it with steak.
Charcuterie.
Yeah.
Juicy, you know? Rare steak.
Yeah, absolutely.
What else? Roast chicken?
Roast chicken for sure. Veal, pork.
So it's pretty versatile.
Yeah, it's very versatile.
What would you eat it with?
What wouldn't I eat it with?
It pretty much goes with everything.
It goes with everything. You know?
So
on its own, it's delicious.
I like this wine. There's almost, when you said the salinity... Up in my nose in a good way. There's almost like a pickle juice.
Yeah, yeah.
Or something. Yeah. Which I love. Yeah. I mean, there's something yeah. very cool about that. You know? It's very nice. So we don't like this wine. We love this wine. You can get it down here. I mean, this is just a great wine for the price for food and
absolutely.
If this doesn't epitomize what a good vigneron, you know, is making and all of that. So that's the Le Haut de Madon from Christian Vignier. Is there a vintage year in this?
This is 2017.
2017. Yeah. That's what's in the market now?
Yes.
All right, and ballpark guess, retail?
I would say anywhere between $19 and $21.
So great price point.
Yeah.
And another thing we didn't talk about on the wine list, and here's a chance. I mean, you go out of your way to stock the list with incredibly reasonable...
Yeah.
The idea of experiencing 2, 3, 4 bottles of wine and not breaking the bank, that's
absolutely.
Part of your philosophy.
Yeah,
right?
It's part of my, it's always been, you know, since the 360 days and even Jonathan, when he first priced the list at Baltazar, did it this way. And, you know, Arnaud did it at 360. We did it at 10 Bells. We did it at Contra and Wilder. And, you know, you say something in the beginning of the show, we bring wine to the people. Wine is for the people, and it's all about accessibility. You know, there are all those wines that are higher-end, expensive because of the rareness of them, but, you know, it's all about accessibility and getting access to these wines at a level that shouldn't be breaking the bank.
That's what it's all about.
And therefore, you can't drink 2 or 3 or 4 bottles of wine during dinner, and, you know.
And you do have some expensive wines on the list, but it's stoked and stacked, you know, with all the other stuff, which is great. All right, Jorge, we're going to wrap up the show. Let me do a quick wrap-up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's Sam at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby. And follow the hashtag The Grape Nation. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. Also subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast. You can get us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. As I said a few times during the show, I'm going to post Jorge's wine list. I'm going to post Jorge's wine selection. And I'll also list a bunch of the wines, you know, Jorge mentioned during the show. The great thing is, if you want to sample any of these wines, Jorge is here most of the time. Come in, say hello. He'll pour you anything. Jorge, it's a funny question. Where can we find you and Frenchette on social media? We established that social media, you're not going to go to...
No.
First of all, you have the craziest handle, which we won't even tell people. But if people want to know more about Frenchette, they can go to the website.
Yeah, go to the website. It's the best.
Yeah. The wine list, you know, per se is on it and all of that. So you could find more about Frenchette, you know, if you just go to Google
search
Frenchette.
Tags Frenchette.
Yeah, to what everyone else.
There'll be hundreds of photographs.
All right, I want to thank our guest Jorge Riera. Jorge is the wine director at, you know, arguably one of the hottest restaurants anywhere right now. And sitting here with him and just the buzz and everything, you can tell why. I want to thank everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.